This is Boston Public Radio. We are really excited about this. We're joined by a champion, a first-of-her-kind champion. She recently won the state championship wrestling in the 106-pound division. Danielle Coughlin is on the phone with her coach, Carl Sincotti, from North Andover. Welcome, Carl, and congratulations, Danielle.
Oh, thank you.
Hello.
Hi, Danielle. Absolutely. Congratulations from me, too. You know, I've got girls that played sports, Danielle. None of them wrestled. And I wondered, you know, was this something that you had to deal with in the high school culture where kids would kid you about this? Or was it just not even an issue for you?
I mean, as soon as I came, you know, the whole team kind of, they knew I was coming up from middle school, and they took me in, you know. They respected me because I came in and worked just as hard as they did. So I didn't really ever have an issue with that.
Danielle, I read in the paper a comment that was made to you by somebody in the stands after you won the state championship. Share that with us.
Oh, yeah. So after I won, I was sitting in the stands, and this guy turned to me and held up his phone and said, "Smile. I want to send a picture to my daughter in Africa and tell her that in this country, women can become anything." And that really is kind of when it hit me that maybe what I did was a little bit bigger than I realized, and that actually made me tear up a little bit. That was really great that he had said that to me.
Hey, Carl Sincotti, when Danielle Coughlin decided she wanted to be on the boys' wrestling team, coached by you several years ago, what was your initial feel? What was your initial take on this? What did you say to her?
Well, initially, like she said earlier, that she wrestled in the youth program, and I used to help out with the youth program as well. So we all knew Danielle was coming up. But one of the things that I said to her is that, you know, you're not going to get any special treatment. And her response was, and she can answer that.
Well, I didn't expect him to at all. Yeah. I'd be offended if he did.
That was exactly what she said when she was coming up as a freshman. So it's business as usual with her. And, you know, we do what we do up here. And if she can, you know, do the stuff that, you know, and practice the way we do, then she's on the team, and she's done that to an exceptional level.
So I just want to be clear. There was no girls' wrestling team, right, Danielle? It was either the boys' wrestling team or no wrestling, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. You know, I got to say I'm stunned. I thought that there would be a lot more difficulty, that people would be protesting, or maybe that boys would – did you ever have a boy say, "I don't want to wrestle against a girl in a match"? Anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I've been wrestling for 8 years, so there's been a handful. You know, sometimes it's kids that are new to the sport, and they don't want to go out against someone who's, you know, has been wrestling for so many years, especially if they're a girl, you know. You know, they don't want to be put out there. But for the most part, if anyone's serious about the sport, they're going to treat me just like an opponent that's in their way of something they want. You know, they're not going to go easy on me just because I'm a girl.
That's the voice of Danielle Coughlin. No one goes easy on her. 106-pound state wrestling champ, or coach from North Andover, Carl Sincotti. Carl, you sound too good to be true, too. You both
I know.
Do. So you tell me the truth. When she walks onto the mat years ago, you didn't have any trepidation. You didn't say to yourself, "Oh, my God," even though she's from a wrestling family, her brother was a champion,
yeah,
too, that you didn't have any concerns about this thing at all? Raise your right hand, Carl, when you're answering the question.
It's up. Concerns about, like, her getting hurt, or I had more concerns of how these boys were going to feel after she goes out and pins them in the first period.
That's a good...
That's great.
How did they feel? I mean, I bet a lot of them were just, "Oh, my God, I just got whipped by a girl."
Yeah, I'm sure plenty of them have. And before we went on the radio, we were kind of figuring out her record. And up to this date, she has 114 wins. So there's a lot of boys out there that I'm sure are feeling that.
And you haven't been pinned. Did I read you haven't been pinned since your sophomore year, Danielle?
Yeah, that's right.
Last question for you, Danielle. What are you doing next year? Are you going to college? And if you are you wrestling? Or is there a woman wrestler in male college wrestling?
No.
I don't think there is.
No.
But there are, you know, women's wrestling teams out there.
Is that what you're going to do? You're going to a place that has one?
Well, for a long time, I figured after high school I'd be done, but, you know, I'm going to reconsider and kind of look into some schools, but I haven't really decided yet.
You guys are both great and an inspiration, I have to say, to virtually everybody. It's terrific. I think we echo what that person in the stand said to you, Danielle.
Yeah, I am stunned, and congratulations. Danielle, one last thing. When you're not wrestling, are you wearing the skinny jeans and the spaghetti straps I argue with my daughter about all the time, and the mascara, the whole nine yards?
Yeah, of course I am. You know, I still wear dress to school. I still, you know, it's not completely who I am, you know.
Okay.
Hey, well, Danielle Coughlin and Carlson Cotti, we're proud of you and we really appreciate your call.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Congratulations.
Thank you. Good job.
To both of you.
Now, thank you.
Thank you both. Now, to discuss whether Danielle Coughlin is an aberration or a sign of things to come, we're joined by Dan Lebowitz. He's the executive director of Sport and Society, a fabulous operation in Northeastern. Shira Springer, of course, is both sports enterprise, an investigative reporter, and a pole vaulter. We know from the Boston Globe. Good to see you both.
Thanks for having us.
I didn't know you were a pole vaulter.
Oh, yeah? You didn't read the piece in the Globe? Hello.
Gee.
Pole vaulting as comic relief.
I am obviously stunned by this. I can't believe that a kid that could be a high school senior, could be in the wrestling team, win the state championship, and not encounter a lot of hassles. But maybe behind the times here.
Yeah, I'm not as surprised. And maybe it's also a bit of optimism and positive outlook here. I would like to think that when you are competing, you know, when it's about competition, when you are there for the competition, whether you're a boy or a girl, a woman or a man, that that's what the dominant topic of conversation is. And if you are serious about your sport and you are there to improve and test yourself against the best in your sport, then that gets respect.
Did you play on a boy? You played on a boys' soccer team when you were a kid.
I played on a boys' soccer team when I was a kid.
Hey, Dan, I hate to be a Neanderthal here, but, you know, when you see...
We're both Neanderthals,
when you see Danica Patrick, you say, well, you know, not saying it's not a hard thing, but you're driving a car, so you can understand how a woman, at least I can understand, a woman can be equal to a man. But I have to say, when I read this thing about Danielle Coughlin, I said, how can a 106-pound young woman be as strong as a 106-pound man? And obviously she's as strong and has the technique. But is this an aberration, as I asked at the top? Or is this something that's going to start happening across all sports lines?
I don't think it's an aberration. I think it's the way that we define gender roles that you would even have thought that. I mean, it's funny. Before I became the executive director at Sport and Society, I ran a training business. I once had a Olympic caliber speed skater. And she was a woman, a young girl, and went to a prep school, the Windsor School, which is considered to
great
be
school.
Sort of the place where prim and proper young girls would go at that time. This is quite a long time ago. And I used to train her as a power lifter for her sport. And we would walk into incredibly hardcore gyms, and there would be men in the back, and they'd be squatting. So I'd walk her back there and say, can we squat with you? And the men would generally say, oh, well, we're not taking off any plates. And then I would gleefully say, well, that's good, because we're adding plates. And we would add plates, and I would start her squatting. We would generally warm up somewhere else in the gym and then go back to where they were. And I would start her at 315, and she would squat that for a full squat 10 times at 120 pounds. And then the men would slink away because they were embarrassed, but really they should have been embarrassed about their thought process, not their athleticism.
By the way, if you want to talk to either of these people and answer the question about whether you're okay with women competing in traditionally male sports, you can call us at 877-301-8970. Shira Springer from The Globe, what's the science on this? I mean, every once in a while in running, I read a story in the New York Times or the Boston Globe that says the whatever the physiology that separates man from woman is narrowing, that essentially the potential for a woman to win a marathon in X number of years, I don't remember what the data was, is there. Are women, because of the training methods and some of the stuff we just heard a minute ago, are women getting closer in terms of strength and those sort of things to men?
I think, you know, as important, I think they are getting closer in terms of strength because of training, because they know more about how to train. But I think that the key element in all of this is opportunity. They're getting more opportunity to train with the best coaches. They're getting more training that is focused on their physiology and what they need to do. They may have, you know, strengths and flexibility, but need to build up more power and explosiveness. So their training is more catered to their bodies. There is more science out there that tells them how they can improve. And there are also more women out there pushing the limits. I mean, you think about the Olympics in 2012 and the way the women and the U.S. team dominated performances there. There are more.
You covered those Olympics, right?
I did, yeah. And there are more role models out there for people like Danielle. There are more role models out there in the form of people like Danica Patrick. And it's, you know, sort of a Roger Bannister effect, if you will.
When you first 4-minute mile
exactly,
guy.
Exactly, the first 4-minute mile. So when you see someone break a barrier, it becomes psychologically and also some, to some degree, therefore physically easier to do.
Our numbers are 877-301-8970. You can call us and tell us what you think about women, or well, there are still high school girls competing against boys on the wrestling team, competing with boys in other sports. I mean, we've had kids, girls play football.
There's a story out of Philadelphia. A kid, 11-year-old, was in the Catholic League there. Now I think the bishop or whoever he is has to decide whether to let her play football with the boys at a higher age.
But here's the thing, and let me be the sexist here. As a female, when you look at boys' soccer teams and girls' soccer teams, and maybe it's because they haven't had the opportunities, but things are pretty co-ed now in the public schools. You know, there's co-ed soccer teams until they're pretty old, and there's running teams that are together till they're pretty old. The difference between a girls' high school soccer team and a boys' high school soccer team in terms of speed and strength to someone like me is enormous. It looks really different. The boys are faster.
Yeah, I think once you get into high school, you're getting into a tricky area physically. But I think one of the things that's to Danielle's benefit in wrestling is that it's weight classes. So, you know, you are 106 pounds and you're competing against someone of a similar weight. And to some degree, I think it might be easier for a female. I'm no exercise physiologist, but easier for a female to stay at 106 pounds, whereas you often hear of male wrestlers needing to shed weight. Now, my experience playing on a boys' soccer team was when I was in middle school and early in junior high school, and it was much different developmentally. But I was slower, and it did take a lot to stay competitive. But that was part of the experiment. Both my sister and I played on the team, and we were there for the challenge. We were there because we wanted to become faster, because we wanted to improve our skills. And I think you shouldn't deny girls, particularly in sports like wrestling, where they might not have the opportunity to compete and to challenge themselves and to sort of punch above their weight to mix sports. I don't think you should deny them the opportunity to do
that. Dan Leibowitz from Sport and Society, great thing at Northeastern. Every time Marjorie and I have discussed this in our former lives, someone calls in, someone's calling in and say, okay, fine, I'm fine with this. I'm a sexist like Marjorie Egan. I'm fine with it. I'm not speaking for myself, of course, now. But for, however, so when my son wants to compete on the girls' field hockey team or the girls' whatever team, my son should be able to do that too. What's good for the proverbial goose is good for the you-know-who. What's your response to that?
Well, I think, again, you know, it goes to what's the larger question about how we define gender roles. So, I mean, part of the reason that people have a view about that is because they have a preconceived notion of gender. When I think about what Shira just said in terms of even high school athletics, I have there's a woman that works at Sport and Society who is the only woman ever to pitch to Major League Baseball players. She actually threw two fastballs by Coco Crisp. She pitched batting
practice. Former center fielder for the Red Sox,
yeah,
right?
She pitched batting practice for six teams, and she's our director of sports partnerships.
What's her name?
Her name is Justine Siegel.
What was the context for this?
So the context is that she always thought it was unfair that she couldn't play baseball, that she was always put into a softball league. And she thought, so she started, before she came to us to intern and now take this role, she had a nonprofit called Baseball for All. And so just recently, we signed a MOU, a sort of a educational agreement with the International Baseball Federation, which she brokered, where they're going to get degrees at Northeastern and the like. But her sort of greatness comes from a compelling desire for equity. She has this compelling desire for equity. So recently she's in France and she emails me and says, isn't it ironic that the best baseball player in France at 15 years old, where they don't have a great baseball tradition yet, and I'll grant you that, is a female. And now at 16,
she's the best of either gender?
Yeah, right. And she's not going to be able to play baseball as a 16-year-old. So this is an issue, a social justice issue in France, and basically a social justice issue as we look at it around the globe. So what we try to do at Sport and Society is talk about gender equity through this great platform of sport. If it wasn't about sport here, we wouldn't be engaged in this conversation. It allows you to be engaged in conversations and think beyond the box that you're thinking in or that most people think in. And, I've been guilty of thinking in the past, and yet—
Thank you for being kind to us, by the way. We appreciate that.
It's a journey. It's everybody's journey. It's a collective journey about what does inclusion mean through sport, outside of sport, and in terms of respect for women in general.
So, Cher, where are we going to read about this next? By the way, our number is 877-301-8970. It's 877-301-8970, Boston Public Radio, if you want to weigh in on this. What's the next threshold? Is it skiing? Is it marathon? Do you really?
Yeah, I really think. I mean, I'm hoping for. I know Lindsey Vonn applied to compete against the men on the World Cup circuit.
She just broke some a couple of weeks ago, didn't she?
She broke. She tore. She basically destroyed her knee.
Isn't she dating Tiger Woods as well? I think she's
rumored.
We're not
going to
hold that against her. But go ahead.
But I think that I would like to see her compete against male skiers. She already uses skis designed for men. She skis and tries to ski, admittedly, in a style that is very male-like because she believes it will allow her to go faster. She is, I think, unquestionably the best female skater in the skier in the history of the sport. And I think she should have the opportunity, as she wanted to do this past season, to test herself against the men. I think that's where we're going to see hopefully, breakthrough.
So why are the times for the men in downhill or giant slalom or whatever it is, why are they...
Height and weight. I mean, they can generate more power with their height and weight. You know, I mean, there is the physics of skiing. You know, they are stronger, they are bigger.
So is there any sport that the physics are not going to hold a woman back from? I mean,
106-pound wrestling.
Well, 106-pound wrestling, but
I would argue that marathoning.
Marathoning,
I think
the women are still what, 20 minutes behind the men?
They're not so much 20 minutes behind anymore.
As a marathon runner, I'm not so sure about that. There is, you know, you'd say 20 minutes, it's roughly that. That's a huge gap of time when you consider
right.
That's almost a little less than, you know, it's what, 40 seconds faster per mile. If you know, when you're running at 5 minute, you know, sub 5 minute mile pace, that is a huge amount of time to make up. I think they're going to narrow the gap. I don't think women will ever surpass that. I don't think physiologically we're ever going to get to a point where women can beat men, unless you're talking about something like Danica Patrick and NASCAR driver, where there is an element of both the physical and the technological and the car. I mean, it's half car, half human.
But before we get away from marathon running, what is it about men and marathon running that enables them to finish the races faster? What is it? It's not so much strength there, because these guys are little teeny tiny guys.
Yeah, but they're still taller. I mean, I think, you know, you look at the average women's marathoner, she's around 5'2", 5'3", 5'4". The men are only slightly taller, maybe 5'6", 5'7", 5'8", but that's still a longer stride length, perhaps a little bit quicker in their stride turnover that allows them. There's just that little bit that allows them to run the 35, 40, 50 seconds faster per mile. And I think just, you know, endurance and stamina-wise, the good news for women, however, is that, you know, physiologically, they tend to last longer. They tend to be able to sustain their careers later into their 30s than male marathoners. So there's an upside.
In radio,
yes, there's an upside.
Hey, Dan Leibowitz from Sport and Society. Let's talk about the second half of the name of your organization, Society. Is America ready for, forget the world, forget France for a moment. Is America ready for this? And I don't just mean men in America. Are women in America ready for this? Or do they see Danielle Coughlin, and I mean the generic Danielle Coughlin, they're more like her, but she's obviously the local star now. Or do they see her as sort of a one-of-a-kind kind of thing?
Well, I think that, you know, sport allows for, as we were talking about earlier, access and opportunity and a variety of things. I think mostly it creates the conversation where she's probably not one of a kind. It's an empowerment tool. It's an empowerment vehicle. If you look 40 years back or so and you look at an event that happened in history like John Carlos raising his fist in 1968, I see a direct line to Barack Obama being in the White House. I mean, to me, you know, now maybe that's just the way I view the world, as sport is a social justice engine, but when I sit with a John Carlos and I watch that inauguration and I see the trials and the tribulations and all the defamation that he faced and all the vilifying that was done around him. And yet we have an African-American president right now.
Well,
and so I think that you can see that same type of progression along a gender continuum as well.
Speaking of race, and a term that obviously was pretty critical about a half century ago, separate but equal. How about this again? How about it? Charlie Baker, when he was here, said that he thought, and Danielle Coughlin confirmed it, there's no women's wrestling team at North Andover. Let's pose another issue. Let's assume there is a women's wrestling team, and if Danielle Coughlin says they're not good enough for me, I'm tougher, I'm stronger, I don't want to do the men, why shouldn't she be restricted to, well, Shira wants to answer that, why shouldn't she be restricted to wrestle against women and whoever we mentioned a minute ago, run against women, and that's assuming the opportunity is there.
I'm going to give you a very personal example.
Yeah.
I competed in cross country and track and field in high school. It wasn't the most competitive cross country and track and field team, though it was fairly competitive. I did a lot of my training with the men's cross country and track teams. That's how you can negotiate that. And my school was willing to set up arrangements where I could travel outside of our school athletic conference and compete against other women and get outside and, you know, see more of the cross country and track and field landscape. And I think it's all about opportunity and competition. It doesn't matter if you have a women's team, a men's team, a boys' team, a girls' team. What matters is the individual athlete getting the level of competition she deserves and that's going to challenge her? It's about challenging the individual. It's unfair for Danielle if there were to be a women's wrestling team if she was not challenged by the competition she faced there. Competition should be the bottom line when you're talking about sports.
That's Shira Springer from the Boston Globe. Before we get back to this gender equity thing, when I read your pole vaulting story, I know it's not on topic, but
That's incredible.
I have to say, the notion of how long are those poles? 15
they're
feet or how long are they?
The notion of
almost three times my height.
Exactly. Planting one of those poles in the ground and then propelling yourself. I couldn't propel myself, but you did. Is that not terrifying?
Extraordinarily terrifying.
So describe, what was it like?
It was very apprehensive, but I will have to.
You were the world champion, with the gold medalist.
So I will have to say, you know, as discomforting as it may seem to have a gold medalist looking over your shoulder and instructing you in pole vaulting, it actually put me more at ease because she approached it with such a fearlessness and such a matter of fact manner that I was like, heck. She can do this. I can do this. I mean, she and her coach, who also happens to be her husband, another interesting topic for female athletes someday. There was such a matter-of-fact manner that you really had – I had myself believing, you know, within 15 minutes, I can do this. And I think a lot of sports is mental, and particularly pole vault, you know, when there's so much going on in your head about where – how you're putting the pole down, the approach, you're lifting off, et cetera, et cetera. Having that mental confidence, that element in place can make all
what
the difference
in the clear?
World. Like 2 or 3 feet. I say this now as, you know, I'm saying, oh, I'm so confident, but it only got me over 2 or 3 feet.
We're talking Dan Leibowitz. He's the executive director of sports and society at Northeastern University, and Shira Springer, a pole vaulter and a sports enterprise investigative reporter for the Boston Globe. Either of you guys can answer this question. Why is it that women's sports, and maybe there are ones that are exceptions, with the exception of the volleyball and the women's volleyball in the Olympics, and I think we know why that's an exception. Why don't more people watch women's sports?
Oh, I wish I could answer that question. I mean, it is a frustration to no end with me. Women's soccer will be trying for the third time to launch a professional league in the United States sometime this spring or summer.
And they're great.
It's a fantastic level of soccer. It is some of the best, as a former soccer player, some of the best soccer you're going to see in the United States. You know, they play the game the way it should be played, smart, intelligent game.
So what is the answer then?
Unfortunately, I think people are drawn more to the novelty, you know? I mean, that's what's making money. It's the Danica Patricks getting the pole against the men. It's Ronda Rousey, you know, winning her UFC fight in what's a male-dominated sport. I don't know how you flip the switch behind, we really want to see women compete at the highest level. You know, flip it from, let's see women as a novelty in sport, to we really want to see women competing.
You know, a couple of years ago, the Boston Herald did a thing. This is what I think Marjorie is talking about. There was two volleyball tournaments in Quincy 3 or 4 years ago. They were the men's either world champions or pretty close. They drew about 14 people. The women's beach volleyball a couple of months later came to Quincy as well, and everybody knows what they're dressed like, and sold out in 6.5 minutes. So, I mean, I think the answer to the question that Shira was posed to Shira is sex, sadly, is what caused so many people to be into the Olympic thing, too. Is that not a sad but fair statement?
I would think, again, this goes back to what we have preconceived notions of what the roles of gender are. And you know, when you get something like that.
Marjorie and I thought the male volleyball players should be in thongs. I mean, in the spirit of fairness, but go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I just say
that.
I think you make a great point, but I think it goes back to what our preconceived notions of gender role is. And I think that's why this is topical, and yet we engage in the conversation so that maybe that changes. Maybe those preconceived – we make some collective movement towards an inclusive thought around sport as a great vehicle and a great medium for both men and women. And also, you know, you don't really see television contracts for women's sports. So, you know, right away, and if you get any sport that isn't getting a major television contract, like the NHL, for instance, you have issue. So
let's let me just squeeze in one quick call before you guys have to go. Alma from Somerville, I'm going to say good afternoon. I'm going to get it right once. You're on Boston Public Radio 89.7. Thanks for calling, Alma.
Hi. I'm calling about the comment about women, men not want to watch women's sports.
Yep.
I think that I'm sure it's complicated, but I think there's a couple of factors. One is that for a lot of boys and men, sports is about fantasy. And you can't watch a woman playing sports and fantasize yourself doing that as well as you can a man.
Shira is shaking her head up and down, by the way, just
secondly,
so you know you're getting a receptive audience.
When most boys and men look at women, they like to think of them as pretty, wonderful, sexual creatures and not being sports and beating them at sports. So there's that part, too. It just doesn't fill the fantasies that they want to have about sports and about women.
I think it's a good analysis. Well, women,
how do you start creating a new fantasy?
How do you start creating a new fantasy?
I think that's the million-dollar, the $10 million question for you know, the new women's soccer league. It's the question for
do you think Danica Patrick would be as huge as she is
no.
if she wasn't great-looking?
I know where you're going with that, yeah. And no. And I don't think Ronda Rousey, as talented as they both are in their respective sports, and as much as they deserve the attention they get, I don't think they would be nearly as popular if they weren't as good looking.
Sure, before you go, can you imagine me getting a 15-foot pole and jumping over it? You can tell the truth. Be honest here.
No.
No, thank you very
much. I'm not sure you can even lift the pole.
Yeah, you get a lot of lift.
I mean,
that's a pole.
Okay, let's leave it there, Shira. Let's leave it there, Shira. Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Dan Leibowitz, Executive Director of Sports Society at Northeastern University, and Shira Springer, the Sports Enterprise and Investigative Reporter for the Boston Globe. Thank you both so much for being here. Coming up, I don't know if this is a perfect segue from sports
it is for me.
Expertise to napping 101 at Harvard and all across America. That's in a minute on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. According to the Center for Disease Control, 41 million Americans, that's about a third of working adults, get less than 6 hours of sleep a night. And the problem, by the way, is not just in the workplace. Last week, a student at Harvard petitioned to get a nap room created. Well, joining us to talk about the art of the nap is the Associate Professor of Psychology at Harvard Medical School. He's Director for Sleep and Cognition. And based on the photos I saw, Marjorie, he is very well rested. Welcome, Dr. Robert Stickgold. How are you, Doctor?
I'm great. Nice to be with you.
Thanks for joining
us. Thank you for joining us. I'm dying to know, since this is your area of expertise, Professor, how much do you sleep in a night?
Oh, I get 8 hours.
You do?
But it's not for moral reasons. It's because I just don't function with less.
You know, I went to Marjorie and I had a morning radio show in our former lives. And before I started, I went to a sleep doctor. And what she told me, and she's actually a colleague of yours, is that you can never really make it up. While a nap is a great thing, she said, if you're going to fool yourself into believing 6 hours of nighttime sleep and a two-hour nap is ever going to equal 8 hours of sleep, you're fooling yourself. Do you agree with her?
I don't know that I do. I think the data is tending to show that 6 and 2 hour distribution can work. It's unclear, in fact, whether it might not be more optimal, and that's a question that we haven't really even understood how to ask yet. But it is the case that you can get away probably with 6 hours at night and a two-hour nap if you actually take the nap every day.
So if you're looking to get the sort of optimal deal and by the way, if you sleep, doctor, 8 hours a night, do you also take a nap or is eight
No.
hours sufficient? Okay.
That's it.
So say you slept for 7 hours a night. Would the best, and you couldn't stretch it out to eight like you do, is the best option for you to sleep the 7 hours and then take a 3 o'clock in the afternoon nap for an hour?
Sure. Or 2 o'clock.
Two o'clock.
You don't want to get it too late, or then it'll make it hard for you to sleep the next night.
Well, and also I was stunned to read that you can have a perfect nap in 20 minutes or less.
No.
So what is the perfect nap? Describe it to me. What's the optimum nap situation, Dr. Stigall?
Well, what's the goal of the nap?
To be refreshed.
But that's just one of the things that sleep does, right? I mean, if you think of sleep as having its purpose to make you not feel sleepy anymore,
mm-hmm.
that's like saying that the reason we have to eat food is so that we don't feel hungry, right? The purpose of eating is not to keep us from feeling hungry. It's to supply us with the nutrition that we need. And the purpose of sleep is not to keep us from feeling sleepy, but to serve a bunch of other functions that include immune functions. It includes endocrine functions. It includes memory functions. And so if you want to get the perfect nap to optimize that, the nap should probably be closer to 90 minutes.
By the way, it also allows us to escape reality. That's one of the reasons I nap. Hey, Dr. Stigall, I read I'm sure it's a major topic of conversation in the world in which you work. Is that, and if I get it slightly wrong, I know you'll correct me, but some studies have been done where if you remove all external stimuli and someone's in a totally dark setting and they don't know what time it is outside, that a human being wouldn't sleep like we do 8 hours in one load every 24 hours, but would sleep in a succession of smaller pieces. Is that accurate?
Well, that's if there's no light cues at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes your life very difficult. I mean, think about it. You would never know if it was daytime or nighttime. So anytime you felt the least bit sleepy, you would probably sleep for a while. And your circadian clock, which is supposed to give you a single consolidated night of sleep, breaks down entirely because it doesn't have any cues to align itself with. Let me give you an alternate statement, which is that if you take people and have them spend 10 hours a day going about their regular daily life, but 14 hours a day in bed in the dark, regularly from 8 p.m., say, until 10 a.m. the next morning, after a couple of weeks of intense sleeping, where they might sleep 10, 11, 12 hours a night, they pretty much all settle down to around 8 hours and 15 minutes. So you can't sleep more than that in 14 hours, and that's sort of what you settle at. And that seems probably to be the normal for human beings living on Earth, where you've got these periods of light and dark.
Well, let's stay on Earth just for one second here. Let's assume you only do sleep 6 hours and you're not doing the nap thing. What are you doing to yourself? I mean, you hear lots of people say, well, I can exist, these great artists, creators, I can exist on 3 hours a night, 4 hours a night, that sort of thing. If you're not getting the optimum 8 hours, what are you doing to yourself?
Well, several things. And first of all, the people who only get 3 and 4 hours of sleep a night, or who say they do, 90% of them get considerably more. They nap a lot during the day, sometimes mm-hmm. without even knowing it. They sleep 14 hours a night on the weekends and don't count that. So the number of people who really get by on just 3 or 4 hours out of every 24 on a day-after-day basis is very few. But what do you lose? We don't know the numbers so much for 6 hours. I can tell you what they are for 4 hours. For 4 hours a night, the amount of antibody you produce when you get an infection or when you get a vaccination is dramatically reduced. So you're going to end up getting sick more. 4 hours of sleep a night for 5 days makes most college students look pre-diabetic.
Really?
You're going to stop. Yep. Insulin regulation is going to go off. You're going to start not processing sugar well. In fact, a lot of the obesity epidemic might, in fact, be due to insulin regulation going off because of people not getting enough sleep. And your ability to use the information that you learned the day before will be dramatically decreased. A lot of the processing of memories that occurs in humans happens not when you're learning or not when you're thinking about it right afterwards, but that night. So the short answer to your question, or the shorter answer, if I can quote my mother, if you don't get enough sleep, you're going to end up sick, fat, and stupid.
Why don't you say that at the beginning? We could have saved time.
Doctor, we're up against the clock. One last question, and I assume you'd say yes. So Harvard is talking about having a sleep room. Apple and Google already do. You think that's a good idea, right?
It's, you know, it's acutely a good idea. It's chronically a bad idea. Harvard had a time when they realized that all their students are like staying up to 2 or 3 o'clock at night. And so they started serving meals at midnight, a fourth meal during the day at midnight. Well, that's the equivalent of putting in the nap room. But what you really want to do is say, what are we doing in terms of the demands we're putting on these students that they can only afford 4 or 5 hours of sleep a night?
Your mother would say, give them a nap, doctor.
Thank you. Thank you, doctor, very much for joining us. Dr. Robert Stickgold, Associate Professor of Psychiatry at the Center for Sleep and Cognition at Harvard Medical School.
Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock, the new editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGrory, and Anne Barrett Doyle, who is keeping track of priests knee-deep in the sex abuse crisis as the popeship turns over. Our show is a production of WGBH Radio. I'm Jim Browdy.
And I am Marjorie Egan.